Hello, I'm Greg Livingston, speaking here with Chris Totten about his game Dead Man's Trail. And for those of us who aren't familiar with Dead Man's Trail, could you fill us in on the general idea of it?
Sure. Dead Man's Trail is a zombie survival horror game based on the old Oregon Trail games and with a few modern twists. So there is actually previously a game that was Oregon Trail with zombies called Oregon Trail, but that was very much based on the 1984 game. This game, we started with looking at the 1992 version of Oregon Trail, but then said, you know, what if we did a 3D looting mode instead of hunting? What if we did, you know, giving each party member a role and making them more important and not just health bars, so that you have to actually think about, you know, oh, is my mechanic going to die? Things like that. So we really wanted to focus on what we liked most about modern zombie fiction, like The Walking Dead or World War Z or other stories where the zombies were just kind of a natural disaster that you had to deal with, but the real drama was in the fact that you had to deal with other humans.
Okay. And on your blog, it says at first developed it with students, but then started up a company for it?
Yeah. I've taught at several game design schools in the Washington, D.C. metro region, and one of the ones I was working at, we had a lineup of classes that showed different parts of the game development process, but nothing that really linked them together. So I thought of, why don't we do a summer program where people could apply to it, and then we would develop a game together, and or at least like part of a game together, and get people a more holistic look at the process. So I had had this idea, and this was, again, before Oregon Trail was really around. This was a few years before it came out. And so I've been kicking this idea around. It was like, well, let's work on something with this. So some people did concept art. Some people did some 3D art. You know, we tried to put something together in Unity. And we ended up with this, you know, little gray box prototype. It was okay, but the gameplay of it was somewhat compelling. So we decided out of that project, you know, and some people have come and gone since then and moved on to different things. But, you know, we chipped away at it. And then I decided with some friends of mine a few years later, well, let's actually do this thing. And that's, we started development on it really in earnest in 2012. But it's been a rewarding experience because me and these friends started it closer to the beginning of our careers and then have since done a bunch of other really impressive things but kept at this. So this is sort of a cool embodiment of all the things we've learned but also a lot of the stupid mistakes we've made. So it's been a nice safe space to screw up a bunch. So yeah, that's Dead Man's Trail.
One of the big things you mentioned is that, you know, obviously it's based on Oregon Trail and it involves zombies. So a big component of it is just survival, making sure you have resources, making sure you have health, ammo, etc. So I wanted to ask, the main gameplay is broken up into two segments, as I understand it. One where you travel across the country in a truck and one where you go into an area and loot it for resources. And so what are those resources that would compel a player to step out of the truck and explore areas and put themselves in that danger?
So one of the things that would make you want to get out of the truck, food, medical supplies, ammunition, and gas. Now, the way we have the demo calibrated right now for showing at public events, the gas runs out very fast, so we've been working with that a lot, but medical supplies are a pretty scarce asset. And a lot of people have noticed that, you know, you'll have situations where the entire party will get sick. It's not like other games where you have sort of a party leader character and that's the one that goes on the hunting or looting missions and their health bar depletes. Everybody in your party is eligible to go into looting missions and all of them have different powers that aid the looting missions. So you may say, I'm going to send the college athlete in, and then she gets just jacked up but makes it back. you're going to be using a lot of medical supplies for her. So that's a pretty scarce resource. Ammo, we haven't implemented forts yet. We're going to be doing that very shortly. But ammunition is actually also going to be your currency. So it's going to have a dual purpose that'll make it scarce. And then the other thing that we have is car parts. You'll be able to loot car parts from those environments as well. So each of these resources goes back to, you know, the two modes work together. Nothing exists solely in looting mode that doesn't have an impact on travel mode and vice versa. So if you get sick or your health is low in travel mode because you got sick or something, you're going to be, you know, you're going to go into looting mode with the same amount of low health. So, and then likewise, there's, for example, the plague zombie in looting mode. If he blows up on you, you get sick because he's infested with germs and stuff, and that'll carry over to travel mode. So everything works together. Looting mode is very intrinsically tied to getting stuff that you need to continue your travels.
Is there ever any reason that the player would, ever any compelling reason for the player to choose one stop over another, or is it just a matter of how many resources the player has?
Right now it's a matter of how many resources the player has. The game will tell you, and actually lets you loot almost at any time. You know, we didn't want to restrict looting, but it's a very difficult mode. Like, so the way that looting mode works for people who've never played the game, looting mode is sort of a 3D isometric. We talk about it as sort of a dungeon crawler like Diablo, obviously not as full featured as Diablo, but it's a that sort of gameplay where you're trying to explore environments and pick up stuff. It's a very dangerous mode in that a zombie horde will come after a certain amount of time has passed. So, you know, we always warn players, because a lot of players, especially at some of these smaller events and especially at more casual events where there may not be full-on gamers going to the event, they will want to just jump in and shoot zombies. And they can do that for a while, but it's the old sort of survival horror where you don't have unlimited ammo, you have pretty limited ammo, and if you run out of bullets, that's it, you're out of bullets. And then, you know, if you stay too long in one spot, the horde will come and then you'll be swallowed up, quite literally in this case, because it's zombies. So, you know, it's one of those things where we really wanted to give players enough rope to hang themselves with, and they do, but after enough playtesting, we've actually hit this really nice spot where the player is always like, I screwed up. It's never like, your game is unfair. It's that people will just be like, I acknowledge that I made a stupid decision. So right now, for example, like the college athlete, which is our melee weapons expert, basically we said we want a barbarian. But we want a barbarian in the modern era. And somebody said, what about a college athlete? Because they kind of have bats and hockey sticks and stuff. And we're like, that's a great idea. Somebody kept drawing like Casey Jones, like from Ninja Turtles looking guys. I'm like, no, that's boring. No, that's boring. No, that's boring. And then I was like, wait, a girl who plays field hockey with like punk pink hair. And then somebody drew it up and it was perfect. And it was, that was our character. But yeah, like she's a little, I can't call her overpowered because she's not, but she like lulls players into a false sense of security. They'll just be going crazy on the zombie hordes and fending them off and running around because she's super fast. And then they just stay a little too long, right? And then that's it. So the reason you don't want to go into looting too much is that it's dangerous. You either go in and you kind of get some stuff and then leave, or you go in and like get yourself lost and then can't get yourself out. And if you do that too much, it just increases the rate at which you lose character. So the reason a player wouldn't want to go in is that it's a risk. And again, we really, through playtesting and events like Gamescape, which is where you saw the game, it calibrates that risk. allows us to calibrate that risk so we understand, you know, is going to looting too much a problem?
It sounds like time is also a resource, that you go into this town with the goal of finding gas or whatever, but while you're in the town, you also have to keep in mind on how long you're there before a horde arrives.
Yeah, and, you know, we're working with our audio designer on some of these assets, but audio is going to play a big part into understanding when the zombie horde is coming. You're going to be able to listen for the horde. We're going to add some screen shake and some other prompts, but we didn't want there to be a timer. We didn't want this to be a game where it's like, you have 3 minutes.
Right, and then you're like watching the clock or something.
Yeah, and that seemed kind of cliche and a little... That felt like it was too video gamey and too much information. And granted, yeah, like, it's great to give the player as much information in a video game as possible. I always tell students, however much information you give the player that you think is good enough, give them 3 more ways of understanding, you know, the thing that you want them to understand. Hmm. Because inevitably, and I've done this myself, where I'm like, some player will be like, I don't understand this, you know, wouldn't it be cool if you had a particle effect there? And I'll be like, there is a particle effect there. And then I will remember, it doesn't matter if I put one there, the player's not seeing it. So I should put a different one there. Because what I think or know doesn't matter. It's what the player sees. So we're trying to add more indicators of right when that horde comes, but we don't want to give too much information because it's not really as exciting. You know,
right, there wouldn't be that sense of risk if you could time, you know, I'm 30 seconds from the exit, so if I just leave when it's 30 seconds till the horde, I'm good.
Yeah, and the cool thing about those zombie dramas, again, that we like, is if I'm reading World War Z, now I've read it several times, so I kind of know when stuff's about to go down, but that first time you're like, when I turn this next page, is everything going to fall apart? When you watch The Walking Dead or read the comic book, when I turn the next page or after the commercial break, is everything going to fall apart? So there's always that risk, and that keeps you on the edge of your seat, and that's what we really wanted there to be, was the sense of, I can keep going. And again, that's what lets people die with this really powerful character, because they screw up and then they look at us and go, I'm an idiot. And then they might have like taken all their awesome weapons with that character, and now they have none of them anymore because the character died. It's great. It's so, it sounds kind of terrible, but it's awesome when players hit that realization.
Right.
Because it's like, it worked. This game works.
Yeah, it still communicated the idea that they could have prevented it.
Exactly. You know, which, again, is really hard to do. It's hard to come up with that difficulty state where it's difficult, but in the way that the player says, I'm not good enough, or I made a mistake, or I slipped. You know, it's like, it's very easy to make something that's just too hard. And then a thing a lot of new designers do is they'll make something that is too hard, but it's too hard because you've been a jerk to the player. You're like, you know, it's like Mario Maker, right? You know, you go on Mario Maker and people will be like, oh, I made the hardest level, and it's because it's a bunch of spinies on trampolines, and you have like one block to charge up your jump, and you have to make the perfect jump to get to the flag. But then there's like an invisible barrier in front of it. You know, nobody's amused but the developer. You know, we didn't want to be that.
Right. I wanted to ask a little more about how enemy encounters affect exploration. You've already mentioned this to some extent, but do players encounter enemies at a regular rate? Is the distance between enemies that spawn in at a level regular, or is there some amount of randomness to it so that the player might take a risk and hope that there are fewer enemies, or they're placed more advantageously? Or...
So they'll spawn faster as the player stays in the level.
Right.
So they'll come in from off tile and start to box the player in. I guess the best way to explain it, somebody at Gamescape actually came up and said, hey, have you ever played the board game Zombie? And that's the word zombies with three exclamation points. Yeah, three. Okay, I have it on my shelf, so I had to check. Yeah, it's that zombies with three exclamation points by Twilight Creations. Uh-huh. And for those who are unfamiliar, it's a board game where you're people in a zombie apocalypse scenario and you have to get to the helipad and get helicoptered out. And along the way, you can go into buildings and get weapons that help you get through the zombie horde. At the end of your turn, you place the number of zombies based on numbers on the parts of the board itself, and then you roll the die and move the number of zombies you want to move. So what it ends up becoming is that the players box each other in interesting ways. So it's this crowdsourced AI of sorts. Huh. But the experience of boxing in each other, like when we set out to make Looting Mode, we actually said to ourselves, you know, this is a really interesting experience. Why don't we just make zombies as though it were a video game? And there is a iPad version of the board game, but it's like literally a translation of the board game. We set out to make, what if this really oppressive zombie experience, like oppressive but fun, scary zombie experience, was a video game, like a real-time video game. So that's what Dead Man's Trail is. You know, we sat there and played it and we're like, okay, so the zombies act in this way. And when you wall off areas with the zombies, they almost act like level design themselves. So instead of it being a car in your way, it's a wall of zombies in your way. The wall just happens to move. And you see this seriously, like you see that in Resident Evil, where there's a really narrow hallway and there's right. a zombie in the middle of it. You know, and I wrote about this in the level design book I wrote. You know, it's like enemies as architecture. You know, you treat the enemies like they're pieces of the actual level design, and you can do really interesting things. And zombies are great for that too, especially when they move in large groups. So that's how we came up with like how the enemies work. That's actually where all the ways that the zombies react to the player comes from. They all come from these precedents and these ideas of like, what if the zombies moved like this? What if they blocked you in like that? What if we translated this game we liked into a video game, you know, things like that.
So you're concerned about giving the zombies more or less a sense of purpose in setting up challenges for the player.
Yeah, the last thing we wanted was for them to be cannon fodder, because this game was really a reaction to zombie games that were coming out at the time that we started making this, which, again, was a little while back, where it's like Resident Evil 5. You know, Resident Evil 5 yeah. was this game. I actually think it's a pretty brilliant game in that they realized that Resident Evil wasn't really scary anymore and was this sort of B-movie, because it gained this lore that was really unwieldy and kind of silly in parts.
Yeah.
but Capcom totally ran with it and embraced it and added a smug, smirking villain in a Don Johnson suit and stuff. And it was wonderful, but it wasn't a scary game. It was just a game where I mowed down a bunch of zombies. So, you know, we didn't want that. We wanted the zombies to be like in, again, those Walking Dead, World War Z, Resident Evil, where they were these insurmountable, horrible, scary things. We wanted them to be slow, but we wanted them, even if you were faster than them, if they vastly outnumbered you and left you with nowhere to go, you're done.
Right.
So that was our strategy for these guys.
Okay. And how did you balance the different types of resources?
Playtesting the living crap out of the game.
You know, well, beyond making sure that they work and all have a functional purpose, would the player value some resources over others? Are there some resources that are just objectively better, or are there other resources that might be preferred by certain types of players?
Actually, I'll go back to the previous answer. I mean, playtesting is helping us calibrate these things at all times. So, for example, you know, at one point we had So we have a lot of weapons in the game, and that was one of the goals we had, was let's have a lot of weapons. And we have all kinds of different guns, and we said to ourselves, okay, so before, for example, it was way more specialized. Like, if you wanted to shoot your shotgun, you had to find shotgun ammo. And in an FPS, that's fine. That works. Yeah. In this game, it ended up confusing a lot of people and seeming like it was very unwieldy. So, again, it was a playtesting issue where we really listened to the players and said, you know, we may think this is an interesting idea and it may seem intuitive, but it's ruining the audience's time. And, you know, we simplified it so it's just quote-unquote ammo. So every ammo pickup is a pile of ammo with all bullets present. You know, kind of like Left 4 Dead. You know, Left 4 Dead, you just go to ammo stockpiles, and it was just a pile of ammo. So you just grab the handful of ammo and load up your guns with whatever it needed, and good to go. And it made it very intuitive.
Yeah, so the idea there is that when you had specialized ammo, it kind of made sense as a designer, but for the player, suddenly there were like a million different types of ammo to keep track, and so that diminished their usefulness.
Yeah, and again, it's that player-centric usability studying of, you know, playtesting a lot and thinking, you know, how much is too much? And it's not even just the resources, it's features of the game. So the thing with working with a game that is based on another game is it's very tempting to be like, okay, so the other game had this, so we should have this because it had it. You know, one example was rest. In the old Oregon Trail games, you could elect to camp for a few days, and that would keep you from moving forward, but it would get your party in better health, and it negatively affected your score for, you know, how fast you could get to Oregon. You know, we sat down, and we kind of had the button in there for a long time, but even just this past week, we all sat around and were like, so we should talk about implementing this. And then we were like, does anybody seem to be missing it, though? Maybe it just doesn't need to exist in our game. So, you know, and again, there's lots of these with things. And again, playtesting a lot, it's the most important thing, I think, in the game development process, is iterating and playtesting and putting your game in front of people and gaining the sense of how to playtest. I've talked a lot about how the player says, I don't understand this, and then we change something. And I don't want to give the impression that we don't have a vision, because we absolutely do have a vision for this game and other games that I've made in the past. But you have to think about it in terms of trends. So if somebody comes up to you and says, hey, wouldn't it be cool if your game had this feature? Wouldn't it be cool if your game had destructible environments? Yeah, that would be cool. And some of them, you know, you think, like, wow, that is a good idea. So maybe you pitch it to your team if it's a really cool idea. Sometimes you have to just kind of politely acknowledge it. But you have to remember, you know, especially if you're an indie developer, do we have the time? Do we have the budget? Do we have the manpower to do these things? So you don't want to put yourself in a feature creep situation. But on the flip side, let's say 20, 50, 100 people come up to you and say, hey, ammo is confusing. Then we're like, ammo is confusing. Let's change it. You know, so again, that was one that a bunch of people said that they were having problems with. So we decided it was a thing that we needed to fix. You know, and there's lots of things in the pipeline like that that we looked at a cross-section of people and said, okay, here's where we need to isolate our attention. So back to the question of, like, how you calibrate these resources, we're still working on that. And it's not that we don't know, it's that, you know, we just want to observe more. Right now, gas is scarce because gas moves very fast. It was a very easy one to embody for our demos, but, you know, it'll be interesting to see how bullets go once we implement the fort system where you have to buy things with bullets. You know, we had playtests where medicine was never a problem, And people were like, it's weird that it's never a problem. We're like, that is weird that it's never a problem. So we lessened it, and now it's like, sorry, John, you just have pneumonia for a while. You know.
So it sounds like your point about playtesting and having a vision, the nugget there seems to me that you have a vision and you playtest as a means of figuring out how to convey that vision.
Yeah, and sometimes you playtest to figure out if your exact vision is the best vision for the product. So I come from an architectural background, and there's this famous architect, Louis Kahn. He designed the legislative building in Bangladesh. He designed the Phillips Exeter Library. He designed a bunch of really cool stuff. But he had this lecture where he said, you know, I asked the brick, what do you want, brick? And the brick said, I quite like an arch. And he said, but arches are expensive and hard to build. And the brick was like, I like an arch. And the point he was making is that the material, the building material does what it's good at. So you shouldn't try to make a brick do what steel does. And I kind of think that applies to game development, because sometimes you make a game and you think the game should be one thing, and then the players, you know, part of it's the players, and sometimes, again, that's that vision where you say, but it really shouldn't be that. You know, we've had players just be like, why don't you just make a game where you shoot at zombies and it's fun? It's like, I don't really want to make that game.
Right.
So that's where that part of it comes in. But again, sometimes you say, well, we want to have this, and then you observe the gameplay and you're like, you know, that thing that we thought was a good idea makes this game suck. You know, the game wants to be what it wants to be, so we should follow the game's lead. And that sounds very strange to think that the game has some sort of, intelligence that tells us what it wants to be, but you learn to follow that as a designer, you know, as you get practice.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it's appropriate you brought up structure, as I wanted to move to level design.
Yeah, I have opinions on level design.
Oh, I heard you wrote a book, so I'm not surprised. In Dead Man's Trail, players will travel across the country, and on your site you have a bunch of screenshots with different locations. How did you make sure each location had a distinct visual approach while still keeping it within the same sense of aesthetics?
Thank you for that compliment. And I say that very truthfully, because as a small team working on a 3D game, so those people who are out there listening who are on small teams, don't build 3D games unless you want to do so for a long, long time. There's about two of us doing 3D art right now, you know, and we're a bunch of people who are not doing this full time. We are doing this as side projects, you know, in various capacities. And, you know, that limits your time to be able to make certain types of environments. So we actually had, until very recently, only about two different looks to the looting environments. A small town environment and a forest environment. And we actually were able to get quite a bit done. And truthfully, nobody really ever complained, but it was a sticking point for us internally, because we knew that it lessened the variety and lessened the visual interest. So to your point, we actually went on the Unity Asset Store, which is the greatest thing ever, and downloaded several packs of assets for different types of environments. So we said to ourselves, okay, what types of environments would we think would be interesting in different areas of the country? We actually divided the map into chunks, and we said, along this chunk, you see that type of place. On that chunk, you see those types of places. And pursued asset packs that were both affordable, but also we felt would convey the type of thing we wanted to see. Mm. Like I said, that was a very kind compliment you paid us by saying everything looks pretty coherent. You know, I just sat down with each one and went, because you can see all the assets in the asset store. I just sat down and looked at them and was like, is this going to fit our game? Is it too detailed? And I know that sounds really weird, but is it too detailed? Because, you know, when you're doing isometric, if it's too detailed from far away, it'll just look a lot like a lot of visual noise.
Right.
You know, if there's too much texture or something like that. So we wanted to think about that and think about, you know, if the proportions were right, you know, and I settled on a few packs and then just went ahead and bought them. And it worked out. But when you're doing that, I would say, again, people who are on small teams working on 3D games, be very honest with yourself. Don't make yourself try to stretch yourself too far and make this huge, expansive vision yourself. And if you do end up in a game where you have set out this huge, expansive vision and you're far enough in that it doesn't make sense to cancel, use the asset store, but be very particular about the art direction, because that's what helped us.
Okay. You end up with the sense of a post-apocalyptic road trip.
Yeah, exactly. Because, I mean, it's worked out. I looked at those assets, I'm like, yeah, that's Dead Man's Trail. That looks like the kind of world we envisioned. But now we have deserts, and now we have a river town. And the other thing is that we downloaded stuff that we felt, it's not like these environments are, oh, and then you enter this other place, and suddenly you're in somebody else's models. We enter this new place, and we have a mix of everything. Every type of environment has a mix of ones that we create ourselves and the asset store stuff. So, you know, you just have to put things next to one another and think, you know, can this work? But it worked out really well. We've been very happy. The thing that allows that is when you're working with art assets, you really have to think about how reusable is something. And we set out to make a lot of reusable assets. So we're able to take those small town and forest assets and reuse them in a lot of different ways. You know, we looked at our forest assets and said, you know, if we add this rocky cliff from the desert pack, then we have Alpine Mountain. Boom.
Right.
And again, this is coming from practice, making lots of games, because, you know, in the time that we've been chipping away at Dead Man's Trail, a lot of us who've been working on this have been making lots and lots of other games. You know, it's not like this is the one ginormous game that we're like, we're going to get into the industry, guys. This is like a project we've just been doing on the side for a long time, but have been very passionate about, and now it's really paying off. But, you know, you learn those things like, oh, I don't just design this piece for one use. I design it and then use it everywhere I can. A lot of design lessons went into being able to get to the point where we could actually take these pieces, reuse them, mix and match with other pieces, things like that.
Nice. Also about level design, getting past the aesthetics and more into the raw structure of it. Do different environments have different structures to explore, you know, whether it's more open or more labyrinthine? And are resources and enemies any different between areas?
The enemies are going to be different between areas just because now that we have that mapping out of, you know, this is later in the journey, this is earlier in the journey, you know, we are going to probably put more of the special zombies, you know, so there's three special zombies, the Banshee, which calls other zombies, the Oozer, which slows you down by just oozing this, like, green sludge out of itself that gets you caught, and then the Plague Zombie, which is kind of like a boomer from Left 4 Dead, it just charges at you and blows up on you, but when you get Plague Zombied, you get sick. So you get, like, whatever diseases it's been carrying around in its, like, bloated, pus-filled body. So particle effects for that were super fun to make. because we are placing some of the zombies, we can throw in a bunch of special zombies in those tiles because we know that they may occur later on. So your question about whether they took on a different character, yes. You know, the levels themselves are really simple in that it's not that we have, like, intricate puzzles or anything like that. The idea of running in, getting stuff, running out before a horde comes takes care of a lot of that. It's a pretty simple, suspenseful thing, you know. And again, we had a lot of plans for puzzles. We figured out through testing that those were both unwieldy from an implementation standpoint, but also from a just a gameplay standpoint, asking people to solve puzzles while running from this zombie horde just didn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Right. It seems like your core quote-unquote puzzle there would emerge from the player finding a route on their own through the level past zombies.
Yeah, and the zombies are a really good puzzle themselves because, you know, structurally, we tried to limit the use of dead ends. We wanted there to be, and again, this is through playtesting. Level design is something that you also playtest the heck out of. We had a lot of dead ends originally, thinking, ha ha ha, we're going to get them, and they're going to be like, oh, that was hard, I'm such an idiot. And with that was like a little too far. The players were like, I couldn't go anywhere and it sucked. So we were like, okay, never allow there to be a total dead end. There's some things that kind of look like dead ends. And there are some areas where if you're getting chased by a horde and you go into this area, you're in a dead end, but you knew it was going to be one, you know? But we've calibrated that to a point. I actually still have to remove a few from the old designs, but for the most part, we got rid of all the dead ends. So one thing, we always made sure that there's two exits from everything. Again, like there's one or two places where it's pretty well telegraphed that you shouldn't go in there, and it's a high-risk situation, but we want to keep those. There's like one or two. In terms of, do the different levels have different characters? Yes. And again, we don't have intricate puzzles, so it's not like, oh, in the river towns, you manipulate bridges and all this other stuff. There are bridges and things like that, but those turn more into bottlenecks. And, you know, the other types of puzzles that we have are because every tile has four exits, we started creating a lot of one-way systems. So instead of it being a tile with four exits, where it's a T junction, and you can go to any of the four exits at any time, you may have two pathways. So you walk in on one, and you can only either go back out the one you came in or go to the other one you have access to. But you can see the other path. And we found that that was a good way to calibrate the difficulty of a level type. So the River Town, I've been putting a lot of those two exit pathways in to make it feel more like a labyrinth, but the small town, because you in the forest, because you encounter them early, you get a lot more four exit tiles. The other thing too is you can always just control that by how complex you make the paths to all the exits. The forest has a few where you can access all the exits, but the pathway is a little more convoluted than, you know, again, the small town, which is like the first type of environment you see where it's mostly just cross streets. Because the thinking would be, you know, oh, well, it's a town and it's on a grid, so it has lots of cross streets. And that's where our levels are. So that's one of the ways we've been calibrating that is, you know, just how many little scenes you put in a level. And I'm borrowing Ananthropy's way of thinking about level design where whatever's on the screen is a scene of action.
Right.
That's been a really useful way of thinking about it because it's like, oh, well, what's this scene? What's that scene? And then you get a lot of stuff in one tile. Some tiles are like four scenes. Through how much content we put in a tile, and for those who haven't played the game, a tile in our line of thinking, at any one time in looting mode, you are on one square of territory. And that's what's on the screen, but you can go off those squares, which we call tiles, and you go to another tile. And that's actually how we randomly generate the levels, is you have a set of tiles, and then when you go into looting mode, it generates the level by selecting tiles and laying them out. So that's, when I say tiles, that's what I'm talking about.
Right.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you played around a lot with how open to keep space and how much distance to put between options the player has.
Yeah, because, again, the original thinking was make everything very tight. Again, like those Resident Evil hallways that one zombie makes or breaks your ability to get in and out of spaces. But we found that when we made them very tight and when we put the amount of zombies we wanted on the screen, we were like, you know, it's just too much. So there are some levels that feel very sparse when you go into them and like very empty. And that's kind of the point because we wanted it to feel abandoned. You know, we wanted this world to feel like there's nothing left, right?
Right.
So that aids that atmosphere, but it also, you know, it feels sort of empty, and then suddenly the zombie horde comes, and then you realize how much of a force they are to make you feel constrained. And actually, that's one of the things that surprised us. Like, I'm very happy with our zombies. The zombies have taken on a character of their own, just with how we've set up the interactions with them. And I credit that. I mean, I can't not credit the programmers, but I also credit like the zombies, because the programmers made them, and then the way they are just turned into these interesting reactions that we were like, holy cow, that's so cool. And, you know, zombies are like, a lot of people say, well, zombies are only in games because their AI is really simple to program and they're kind of stupid. That's true. But because the way that these guys flock around, it's just, they're so interesting when you're in this situation. You're like, I'm not even mad. That was cool.
It's that idea of the zombie horde as kind of dynamic and moving level design.
Yeah. It was cool the first time we ever really pulled that off, because we were like, oh my gosh, we're actually kind of onto something. It's a game that I can honestly say I have fun playing, even though I've been making it for way too long. And it's also this piece of software that I get frustrated with. But somewhere deep down inside, even I can still have fun playing this game because of these interesting dynamic situations that never quite feel the same way twice. You know, it's been cool. It's been really interesting.
Nice.
Yeah.
And so I think we've hit on this in the course of our discussion, but I got to get your official answer.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to video game design, what is the most important part? The game itself, the intention of the developer, or the experience of the player?
Because I'm tempted to just be like, they're all important. I'm going to go with the experience of the player, because I feel like, no, I will say that. So I was weird when I was in architecture school, and not weird in that I like was like, I wasn't like, you know, the studio weirdo, or, you know, the guy that didn't talk to anybody or anything. But I mean that in that architecture academia now is very focused on like the form. So like what the shape and the form and the presence of the building would be. It's very postmodernist, but I was always really interested, and I totally blame this on video games. I was always really interested in what the people inside the building did and what they thought of the building, which is very modernist, but also very, you know, like medieval and classical and stuff like that. Where I use that as the answer to the question is that that's what led me to be a game designer, is I was interested in what people did in the buildings, and game design lets me design what people do in the game. And I think that's really important. And the other link that makes me say the player's experience is that there's a lot of games out there that are about things. I mean, this is a big thing in game academia right now, where a lot of the people who are in important positions make games about things. And that is provocative to some people. And I think the younger generation of game academics that care about the games because they are people who grew up with the games and appreciate the game itself as a designed thing. And they care about that because they had a good player experience. Mm-hmm. So I've played a lot of games that are about things that are getting by totally on being about the thing, but so when are really crappy games.
So when you say about a thing, you mean like some kind of philosophical or sociological topic, like Papers, Please? Or?
No, that's one that's really good. Let me make no mistake. I'm not talking about like the good games that are about things like Papers, Please. But I think there's an area of games research that is about, and I'm not trying to knock it. I think there's a section that gets away with a lot because of their theme. And I'm not saying games shouldn't be about real world topics, but if you're going to make a game about a real world topic, make a game that is an awesome game that makes us think about a real world topic. And this is where, again, to your question, I'm not trying to derive from the question to go on my own tirade. You know, you asked, is the game itself important? Well, yeah, it's important, but those are cases of where the game became too much and the intent of the author became too much. Mm. And there's almost no player experience.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Papers, Please is a brilliant game because, thank you for bringing up that example, because there's going to be some person listening that's like, oh, but Papers, Please is amazing. This guy's an idiot. But no, Papers, Please is a great game because I sit there and I'm like, I'm collating documents. This is amazing. So good. Why am I having fun?
And that's something you would expect to say.
Yeah. And like, oh, but that made me super duper think about how sad it is for refugees. And that guy with the crayon colored passport is hilarious. But he also probably has something really horrible going on in his life. That makes me think deeply. That's why that game is good.
So Papers, Please hits that stride where it's about a thing, but is also like an engaging player experience.
Yeah, but there are games where there's just nothing there, but they're like, but it's about this thing. It's like,
Okay.
Yeah. So that's why I say the player experience is really important, because if the player experience is good, everything else works. Everything else can work.
Right.
And that's why I place such a huge emphasis on play testing, is because, like, I've made art games. In fact, last year at Gamescape, I showed it. Well, this year at Gamescape, I showed an art game, too, you know, that a colleague of mine and I were working on. So last year, I showed a game based on the graphic design of Russian constructivist artist El Lazisky. And it was an art game in that it was made to question the way we make game art, because I used fine art materials instead of game art materials, and it was me exploring this process of game making. And I did that by translating this guy's artwork into an abstract recreation of Yar's Revenge. But like, I could have made something way more avant-garde or something like that mechanically, but I'm like, but I need to make this fun.
Right.
You know, this has to be good. It has to be interesting. And people liked it. But that was one of the games where, to my playtesting discussion, and where I think the player experience is really important, that was actually a direct clash between the intent / the game and the player experience, because it was based on this work called Beat the Whites with the Red Wedge, which is this, like, the red wedge of bullshit, of communism, was stabbing at the white circle of the czar, his whole regime in Russia at the time, and it's this very famous piece of Russian artwork. So I playtested it with some of my students, and they were like, yeah, no, it's really hard to figure out when you can attack, like, because I had this thing where you had to charge up. So it's like, when you can attack, so like, what if it's just, it changes from a wedge? When you can attack. Maybe it's like a rectangle. And it was like, if it were any other thing, sure, but it has to be a wedge here because it was based on the original art. But that was like still really important feedback. Oh, the player's not picking up when they're powered up.
Right.
I had to find an alternative design method and answer around this problem, which was more particle effects, which is always the right answer. But, you know, I had to design around this question of, okay, the player isn't picking this up, and I can't change the shape of this thing because it's based on this specific piece of art. I have to figure out some other method to show that the player's powered up. But I could have totally just been like, well, screw you. No, it's my vision. But... No, I was like, no, I want you to have fun playing this thing that I'm then going to go write some papers about. So, long story short, I really highly value the player's experience with games and will fight people over it.
Ooh.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining me. Is there anything you would like to spread the word about? Any websites or Twitters?
My Twitter is Totter, T-O-T-T-E-R, 87. And Dead Man's Trail's website is dmtgame.com. I'm down in the D.C. area. Anybody who's listening from that area, come down to IGDA D.C. They have really great events, you know, including some local indie game showcases, which Dead Man's Trail will hopefully probably appear at. So, yeah, come on out and have fun. And if game developers are out there, keep making cool things and stick with your projects. Don't run away from them.
Nice.
Like I did with Dead Man's Trail.
Oh, well, running is part of the gameplay there.
You know, it's interesting. I've been making this for a really long time, but one of the things that I realized the longer I've been doing this at an indie stage is everybody has a game like this. It's very rare that you find somebody who hasn't been working on their game for several years. If you're making your game for way too long, and this will sound kind of weird, relative obscurity, people should want to have their game be popular, but get popular at the right time. You know, don't get popular right away. Have a viable product and then work on getting popular. You know, because if you put yourself in a situation where you then have a very big ability to fail, like I was lucky to make Dead Man's Trail in a situation where I could develop it in kind of a safe space because it was this quiet, long-term project. And my friends were like, oh, Chris, you're still working on that? But, you know, they're my friends, so they're joking around with me. But safe spaces for developing, and I'm not saying, like, you know, don't show it to people and keep it under wraps so nobody ever says anything bad about it. People telling you it's bad, it helps you make it good, but we were able to get a lot done and get the thing we wanted because we kept it fairly local, kept it within a few groups, a couple local showcases, and now we're really starting to get the word out there.
Okay.
Yeah. So there's nothing wrong with taking way too long on a game. Just don't make it the only game you're working on.
Some inspiring words.
Yeah.
Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me.